This is tape number two of a conversation with Mrs. Gloria Richardson, March 2nd. Let me return to the matter of the Neo riot in Jackson, Mississippi, in Jackson College. By a common report, Mr. Evers, in the middle of a disturbance, worked to get the students back off the street, and to a degree succeeded. Now, you were saying to me earlier that you felt that this method had dangers for future demonstrations and had dangers in effect on the white expectations about. Can you explain that, please?
Yes, I think it is true. I think in the situation in Jackson, that actually would certainly, if there was a random kind of behavior there, students should have been withdrawn. They should have been withdrawn and regrouped, talked to, and do the type of thing where you sing some freedom songs and have a prayer session, and taken immediately back out again, because you get the, you're running the risk and the danger, it usually happens, that the white obstructionists think they have used violence to curb you. And this means that the next time you go out there, you're going to be worse. In the meantime, I think from the point of view of the students, as in the case of Jackson, that are involved, it would have been better for them to go right back out again and to have relieved the frustrations that they certainly must have had, the anger, to an immediate nonviolent demonstration, rather than to pull them off and send them back and let this thing build so the next time an incident happens, you allow them to get it be completely out of control. You're dealing with human beings, you can't always regulate everybody's behavior in a group. And I think you have to find some immediate way to allow them to relieve the anger and the frustrations and the type of thing. You can't let them feel that these people have been used violence against us and there's nothing we can do, because then certainly they will probably, you know, go out the next time deliberate violence.
How serious are these splits in theory and in practical leadership, you think?
I don't think the splits are very serious, because I think the grassroots people that students have been working with, I think the students understand this. I think those of us that have been working in both situations understand the type of thing I've been talking about. But then you get leaders within the movement who have little contact with the man on the street, so to speak. And they are more or less sitting in their offices and, you know, they know what's going on, but they aren't out there with the people, you know, right out there in the middle with them, knowing what they're feeling or being able to tell what they're feeling or what they're thinking and the momentum of their behavior. However, I think the large amount of people in the movement we reside to, we just get a few other people that are acting, for example, the way Charles Evers does, perhaps because he hasn't had a lot of experience with the direct action on a massive scale.
But of course, he is a native Mississippian, has seen a lot of life there, mm-hmm. and presumably knows as well as anyone could the local world, having been born and raised there.
Well, I think this probably is, I don't know, maybe he knows it and he doesn't comprehend it. I think there are a lot of things, you know, involved there that possibly, because he's older, possibly because he's a man, he doesn't understand. This is the only thing that I can glean from his behavior, or the things, you know, that he said at that particular time, because nonviolent direct action is almost a thing to itself where leadership is concerned. It is not merely just going out in the street, you know, leading a group of people down there. You have to be prepared to try to deal with almost any type of problem. You have to realize the psychological impact as far as the demonstrators are concerned, as far as the white community is concerned. And you have to use it. And these people that are committed, all of us are committed to nonviolence, they have to realize that you can't back down in the face of it.
What impact on the white community is one aiming at?
Well, at this particular time, as far as I'm concerned, as far as the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee is concerned, we have come to the conclusion that, as again, sitting in restaurants and this type of thing, that there has to be programs devised. And this is certainly something we're going to have to learn step by step, using direct action and using voter registration that will attack both the political and economic structures of the community to the extent where they will be willing to deal with the problem of segregation, because it just isn't practical for them not to.
You mean boycott, for instance?
Boycott, all the nonviolent demonstrations, all of the nonviolent techniques that you can use, sit-ins, and even in foreseeable future, civil disobedience.
Of what order exactly? I mean, for example.
And so far as the civil disobedience is concerned, we're blocking off the town, you know, and stopping traffic, stopping business. And I think within the area of civil disobedience, you start just like you did in the demonstrations as they're going now. You start at one pace, and you build up. You have to play it by ear, you know, step by step to find out how far you have to go. And I certainly think in hardcore places like Mississippi and Cambridge that you're going to have to plan for this.
By civil disobedience, you mean lying in the streets, blocking traffic?
This is true. Blocking the plants, anything that you have to block to disrupt the business communications, because unfortunately, this is apparently the only thing that the white community understands is when you hit their pockets. Now, quite often they can hold out on boycott, because usually they have investors, and you know they can play it out. People that are in control for a year or two, and they're still getting nowhere.
Dr. Abernathy told me that the boycott, selective boycott in Atlanta had worked very successfully. It had 100% return on that effort.
In connection with
Atlanta.
Direct action. In connection with demonstrations, yes.
He said,
yes, the people are participating. But Atlanta at this point has not given in on any negotiating points so far.
No, he was thinking about the firms that are hit. I've negotiated very quickly and satisfactorily.
As far as I see.
And the same thing is true in Nashville, that the boycott got immediate action on that. That as I understand it, every request was or demand was fulfilled after the boycott.
You have different situations here also that you have to realize. For example, in Atlanta, they had this very beautiful image. This is like Cambridge. And I think those people, when demonstrations started around Christmas time and the boycott was put into effect, did not really want it destroyed, you know, completely destroyed. And I think they were willing to negotiate more quickly. But now in the state of Mississippi, where the resistance all along has been hard, they have a bad image. They don't care. I think boycotts there and the Negroes there, you know, control very little of the buying power. And it's in instances like this that I think it possibly will not be effective just using a boycott alone. You're going to have to do something that will also keep the whites away from these business places, you know.
Demonstration.
Exactly, yes. And I think that's going to have to be gone into, and certainly I suppose when it does, there is going to be blood spilled.
There's another question that's hovering around the outskirts of this conversation. Maybe you already answered it, given your opinion of it. James Baldwin says in his last book, that the Southern mob does not represent the will of the majority of Southern whites.
No, I don't think it does. But the mob is out there speaking for them. And usually the rest of the whites that the mob does not represent are also subservient to the power structure or the establishment, in quotes, whoever is economically and politically running these states. So they're silent, you know.
They're solid, yes. They've been a default in leadership.
That's right. And so then, therefore, you're only dealing with the mobs. But I don't think, even in Cambridge, for example, the mobs represented all the opinions. The point is, the rest of them are silent, and you have no way of knowing, you know, what they're doing, what they're thinking.
Van Woodward made a remark in a conversation not long back that there was fear was the factor in the South.
Mm-hmm.
There was fear of white man of white man.
This is true. No, and they are worse off really than the Negroes, because the Negroes getting out and fighting, and they won't. They just, you know, sort of stand there and take it.
It's a question of finding a focus for that opinion, then, that sentiment that is different from that of the mob and the hardcore segregationists. Is it a problem of finding a focus for this body of opinion?
A focus, and it's my opinion, really, that some of the white students that are involved in the movement should really go into these white communities and work sort of as field secretaries there to find out what their problems are and what they want to do as a part in the civil rights movement, and to try and motivate these people and give them courage, because certainly there are points where, like when we're asking for more jobs for everybody and better wages for everybody, you know, there are certain programs and points where they can get together and probably defeat the present political structure and perhaps put someone that is going to think for the benefit of the whole community and to back these people. You know, let them know that when they vote, you know, not all black votes and not all white votes, but a mixture of votes, because these people want to live in a better life and live in a better community.
How is Negro registration in this neighborhood?
It's very good so far. We've run several programs within the last 2 years on Negro registration.
How many, what's the percentage of registration, Negro registration, say in Dorchester County?
Within the city of Cambridge, it's about 85%, they're about 85% registered now. As far as Dorchester County is concerned, I would say between 65 and 75%.
Well, this political potential has not made itself felt in terms of civic policy, though, has it?
Well, no. The only time you can make the voting potential here felt is in the case of a primary. And we last fall, we did a voter education and voter registration project here, and we were able to affect 3 offices. This is the initial project, and actually, we intended to work on this more this summer. We got so involved with the way things grew up in Cambridge, we've not been able really to do the type of thing that we should have been doing on it. In a swing block vote, we did enough for the people downtown to realize that this is going to have to be a thing that we reckon with.
They know that now?
Yes, they know that now.
But it's had no effect on situations that, so far?
No, and there has not been an election since then.
I see. But then they can't. They can predict this, but don't face it. Is that it?
That's right.
They just don't face the consequences.
They don't face it. No. And then you get the type of thing where there's certain people in the white community that feel that there's certain people in the Negro people community that can control these votes, you know, and tell the people what to do, so to speak. And this is no longer true, since the civil rights movement has reached the momentum here that it has.
They still think there are some Negro politician or white politician who can deliver.
That's
the Negro vote in his pocket.
Right.
Is that it?
That's it, and that's not true anymore.
But they don't.
There may be someone in the civil rights movement that can deliver it, but not.
To the main street down here.
No.
Things can move very fast. Memphis, 7 years ago, was a very different city from what it is now.
Yes, I understand.
And that's right. It's really the capital of the Delta.
Yes.
More than Clarksdale is, in a way.
Yes, that's
and the local paper there, 2 weeks ago, ran a strong editorial without any equivocation in support of the civil rights legislation. It's mandatory, and it should be done immediately. This is the Memphis paper.
I think this shows, you know, once you have shaken and changed the political structure there, then everybody begins to act like they have, you know, or act with the sense that they are. That they already do have. But just like you say, you get this fear of white against white, and because of economic and social reprisals that go into effect within the white community, even the newspaper editors aren't going to do it so much. They're confined to that area. And I think in the case of what you said about Memphis goes to prove this, that once they decided to work and everybody's backing it, that things begin to level off.
Well, the Negro is a big political power in Memphis, and there's a very strong leadership there, I understand, among young lawyers, and very able young lawyers, I understand. Mm-hmm. One's named, I think it's Alfred Sugarman. Well, I don't know him. Mm-hmm. I hope to meet him. But apparently they are very able and have made a real effect on the whole tone of the city. Something else I notice around here, some of the things like the Thunderbolt, you know, that newspaper, segregationist newspaper, the States Rights Party
mm-hmm.
newspaper,
mm-hmm.
floating around in restaurants here and things like that.
Really?
Oh, yes. I was this morning there on the, I read one down here at the corner restaurant. And I went down for a cup of tea. This is one of the most extreme examples of such a paper I've ever seen. The address, published in Birmingham, mm-hmm. the National Civil Rights, National States Rights Party. It's their organ.
Well, see, we had this problem. We had this problem here about a month or 2 weeks ago. We really heard the Klan was in here. And the segregationist group here, which is called the Dorchester County Business Management Association, announced they had been approached by the White Citizens Council and the Klan to have chapters here, you know, to organize. But they thought these people were too extreme, so they organized the National States Rights Party.
That is the this organization, the National States Rights Party. Have you seen that paper?
No, I'd love to
well,
see it.
Well, I have never seen anything more extreme.
They're trying to make it national. I mean, they're trying to, you know, originate
well,
in Cambridge.
Well, the National States Rights Party, according to this sheet, this newspaper, mm-hmm. is it makes the Klan seem tame. Now, I've just been reading it down this morning.
Well, you tucked a copy in your pocket.
Well, I wish I had, but I didn't. Under the eyes of the owner of the place, I didn't think I could afford to.
Mm.
And keep this apartment.
Robert, yes, yes.
I did take the address. The publisher. Mm-hmm. I can give it to you if you want. But it was the ordinary things, you know, mm-hmm. all the most inflammatory material. And the men at the counter were looking at it together, and I noted their conversation, took notes in their conversation while sitting there. But
see, this is bad.
The National States Rights Party is not superior to the Klan. Is according to their publication, and they avowed this is the most inflammatory material you can imagine. The old, old stuff.
That, of course, means the white community is quieting down. They've got to inflame them again.
That is the reason, is it?
I should
throwing these things around.
You see, the fight is getting a little tougher, I think, now because. They could yell about private property and get people, you know, aroused. When we were in the area of public accommodations, but we moved in on the job, moving jobs in education, really presenting a program that would benefit the entire community, which means that, as I say, you know, there's going to be some point at which both communities are going to focus on the same thing, and the white community, I think this is what they're afraid of.
Does that apply to this situation between the poor white and the Negro? But there's a fear in the ruling group, the
yes.
power group,
yes.
of a coalition between the
yes.
poor white and
yes.
the Negro, and this is a deliberate attempt to split the...
to keep them apart. That's
keep them
really
apart.
Why I think they get hung on this public accommodations thing, don't want to work on any other problems that we or demands we presented, because they know that once you see, they work together anyhow. And once they find that they have common problems, then the men that are, you know, getting all the money in the town, pocketing it, are going to be out of commission. Because I have here and there talked to some whites here in town as I occasionally come across them, and they have some of the same complaints against the white power structure that we have, except as I say, they are going to fight with them.
In other words, you see behind the race tension, the race conflict, also another alignment of a class conflict.
That's right.
And these don't match, but the fact they split differently.
That's right. Yeah, one's going
right angles to each other, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
But you sense the possibility of the class or economic conflict becoming major and the other minor. Is that?
Yes,
As a long range possibility.
That's right. That's what we are attempting, beginning to attempt here. Because actually within the white community, they say the better jobs for the families that have lived here, the better families, these type of things. You go to the tennis store and you know that these are these poor whites that are in there. You go to the better dress stores and you know, and they allow them to have old family names from Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And that's another reason why I think we can't just get put crack, because these people, you know, are living well and comfortably. They don't really care. As long as they can do that, they haven't quite realized what it's going to mean for the whole of Cambridge and eventually themselves.
In what sense?
Well, I think they're concerned now with maintaining their position and their control. They don't realize that eventually by doing that, by resisting the civil rights movement here, they're going to destroy the whole town. When that happens, they're destroyed because there's going to be a town here
they
have to make money from.
They're defending the interests in a very short-sighted way there.
That's right.
They are cutting off the nose to spite the face.
That's right.
Economically mm-hmm. speaking.
Economically and possibly politically speaking.
And politically speaking. We all know some of the stereotypes set up by the white people for the Negro.
Mm-hmm.
The labels applied to Negroes, even though the labels are sometimes contradict each other.
That's right.
But what about the Negro stereotypes as applied to white people? Could we explore that a little bit? How would you define
yes,
that?
Yes, I think the same stereotypes apply, except that if you take the color out of it.
Well,
You have lazy whites, just like you have lazy Negroes. You have whites have illegitimate children, as well as Negroes have illegitimate
yes, we know these facts are true. But what are the stereotypes that the Negro applies to all white men in general? Say all white men are lazy, as some white men say all Negroes are lazy. What stereotypes that correspond that are projected on the white people then from the Negro side of the same order?
You don't get it.
Don't get it?
They might call them crackers or segregationists, but this is about as far as it goes.
Now some sociologists, Negro and white sociologists turn up in some localities very definite stereotypes
about the white.
The white, the same corresponding stereotypes, not the same adjectives. You won't
find I think if there's any stereotype coming from the Negro community, as far as my experience is concerned, it's that they idealize the white man. You know, this has been projected. This is a brainwashed in the white community too.
You mean that
they think that they're, you know, smarter and more ambitious and more intelligent and this type of thing.
Oh, they've accepted the white man's evaluation of himself.
That's right.
That's a stereotype you find.
Yes.
Not the stereotype of the white man being cold, or the white man being sly, or the white man being this or that. The stereotypes that are derogatory. You don't find those?
No. Well, sly, yes.
Sly.
Mm-hmm.
Cold.
It isn't the same type of stereotype that they apply to us. It isn't quite as derogatory. Because you might, in a business transaction, apply these terms of slyness and coldness, you know, to a business competitor, regardless of color. That's why I say I don't think it's as racial as the stereotypes that are applied against us.
Do you still think that the acceptance of the white man's evaluation of himself is as strong as it was, say, 20 years ago?
No, I don't think so. In fact, I know it isn't. It's becoming less and less. But what it has done, it psychologically left a blight on Negro personalities. Subconsciously, while a lot of them know this isn't true and they resent it, they're fighting against it, but subconsciously, you know, it's there, it's left a mark.
It's still working subconsciously.
Yes, and you get this when they, a lot of them, you know, will come to you to ask you to fight a problem for them, and they can do it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Education is a big thing, you know. If they don't have a certain degree of education, if they're educated, they think they can articulate and work out their problems, which isn't true, they can. A lot of them do it. But then they get sort of unstable along the way.
Clearly, many
and
do.
They, yes, and I think this is also because they have, you know, we had to repeatedly go back again and again and be refused. This happens in the areas of welfare and getting their welfare and their employment. very poorly.
Is there resistance to voter registration here of that sort? I mean, embarrassing the applicant?
No.
There's no attempt to embarrass the applicant for registration?
No. There
is a weapon?
No. If it was, they wouldn't, if they went down and registered, they wouldn't accept it. They, in one program, we were sending people down there, and I went to challenge the election, and they told me all the people were drunk, you know. And I said, it's ridiculous. There may have been one or two people in there drinking, but we sent them down with people we know, you know, whether they were or not.
When applying for registration, you mean?
This is when, yes. And they had made a few remarks, and of course the people that went with them got them straight. But it was this attempt that I don't deliver, and they didn't intimidate them. Where you get the trouble is it's not in registration, it's in voting. They begin to intimidate. You don't vote this way, you lose your job, you pay you this much and that much. Or you don't get out here and work to get some more votes that way, you want your vote to look.
Is there a threat of physical violence, this intimidation at the polls?
No, not yet.
It goes before the election, or just be coming around saying, what's your vote worth? Just the bribe.
Mm-hmm.
How could they check the vote?
Now this I don't know. How they can check it. If they have voting machines there. You know, before they had the ballots.
Yes.
They usually have a pretty good idea of what they're voting and using. But that's the one thing we established last fall in the when people were voting on the voter education program. But regardless of whether you agreed with whatever evaluation of the candidates that we had at the present time in canvassing the county's opinion, then go in there and vote. But don't let anybody pay you for it. You know, vote according to your convictions. And of course, we outlined the fact that they use this also to maintain control of the Negro community. We're going to have to change some of these officials. Even if it was one bad official for another bad official, we're going to have to try to use our vote to change them. So the next time around, we can say, now, what are we going to do? And they got this. And within the environment of the Second Ward, even the judges and the people downtown said it was the coolest election they'd had. More people turned out. We already juggled the voting machines. We had approximately 1,000 people who turned out to vote. They went in and voted and turned around and came back out. That was it.
Well, that would seem to imply that they are aware of some political potential then.
Well, they are aware now, and always you find this when you have a direct action program going on, because you can get them to see that this also is another arm of the movement. Now, in perfectly ordinary times on voter registration, it would probably be much more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But now they're becoming more and more aware. They're noticing more and more what public officials are doing and saying. And they're sort of keeping an eye on it. I don't care how little education they may have had, you know. And you have the TV and the radio now. Most people have these, and they listen to what they hear on the radio. And they can usually make a pretty fair judgment what's going on, even politically. And as I said, with the direct action programs going on here and various other programs here, they are more concerned than before. You don't get the same type of apathy. Because before they had the idea, I did too. You know, it's important you're going out here and vote because you just, all of them are alike. And we have managed to change that to some degree.
Back to another matter of politics. I remember at the Nonviolence Conference at Howard,
yes.
There was very strong anti-Kennedy sentiment around. Very strong.
Yes,
remember.
Yes.
As a traitor who had...
This is true.
What effect has the assassination had on that sentiment, as far as you can tell?
I don't think the assassination has had any effect, because I was also one of those people. It's an anti-Kennedy thing. But I think all of us realize this man has been the first man to make a moral commitment. He had not, as far as the Justice Department was concerned, they had not acted as he felt they should have in circumstances. But always, we also realize that if you do not apply pressure to these people, then they aren't going to do, because they're involved in other problems, you know, the running of America, and they're involved in political problems themselves. So it's going to be up to us to carry the fight, up to us to make the criticism.
The as
you so would that they can act.
Then as you didn't share the sentiment, well, clearly you don't, Kennedy, there are two sentiments, I'm garbling this. On one hand, the sentiment sometimes emerged that Kennedy's death is almost a providential act, you see, as punishment for being, you know, heel-dragging nut, having betrayed the Negro, and some glee at his actual death in some quarters, you see. Extreme form being Malcolm X. And
I think he said, the chickens had come home to roost.
Yes.
I said the same thing when I saw it on TV. And I have no, I have no accusation against Malcolm X for saying this. Because I was extremely sorry about President Kennedy's death, you know, I was extremely upset about it. But when I thought this, it was because this man had been shot down in one of these segregationist areas. The same thing has been happening to our people. And I was of the opinion that now people in the Justice Department, his brother, those people around him could for the first time see, because this was a personal thing, but for the first time see what we had to run up against, and possibly see for the first time how the machinery of the FBI was not working as efficiently as possible, even in regards to the president's death, and to see how frustrating it was to find out they couldn't send these people in from Washington immediately in there to investigate and take over in the case of even the President of the United States' death. And I think possibly this is what Malcolm X also had. Of course, it's a very crude expression, but to be perfectly frank, I thought the same thing. That was mm-hmm. the context in which I thought of it. Because I had said to Robert Kennedy during the July the 23rd agreement that if he and his brother came to George F. Kennedy, he might be shocked. This man simply did not understand this. He thought this was sort of a joke. He really did not, and I could see that he did not occur to him that there was that much violent, even if it was a small minority of people in the context of the entire population, that felt this violently that they would shoot the president or Robert Kennedy. They
yes.
came into an area.
Yes.
They didn't conceive of it, which was bad, you know. And but now I'm positive that they do conceive of it. And I'm very sorry that it happened. I'd much rather have President Kennedy up there than have President Johnson.
You don't agree with some people then that Johnson may be effective politically in the civil rights legislation?
No, because I think that will only be a small thing. Civil rights legislation really isn't going to do that much for America. That's my opinion. It's going to be like a Supreme Court decision in 1954. It's going to have to be implemented, and that's where you're going to run into trouble. But I think that Johnson is going to try to gain quite a bit of political stability within the Negro communities for pushing a civil rights bill. And I don't ever trust a complete politician. It was my feeling that although Kennedy was a very good politician, that there was always a point at which he had some particular idea of his own. I don't feel that about President Johnson. I feel he's just a cold-hearted politician. When you get to that point, anything can happen.
Do you feel this because he's a Southerner or just because he's himself?
Just because he's himself, I think. I know some Southerners that I think, you know, are very fair-minded, but I think this is because of he himself. And I think he's a very shrewd maneuver. I can see him getting up here saying, you know, he's got to pass this civil rights legislation, and he knows darn well chairmen of all the committees. All we have to do is buck him. You know, we can never put him off the committee, we can throw him out of office. He can't do it. He can get up and take one position and know the machinery is going forward to stop it. And this is what I expect from him.
Let's go back to the other attitude toward Kennedy's death, which one encounters, that he was another Lincoln. You know, the great emancipator again.
Well, I don't think Lincoln was the great emancipator.
Well, all right, that's something else. How do you interpret Lincoln? How do you
I think Lincoln did what he had to do at that particular time to save the Union. It was a practical thing. I don't think it was out of any particular love for humanity in regard to the Negroes.
That would seem to be the record anyway, wouldn't it?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That is, he would be somewhat like Lyndon Johnson then, is that it?
I think so.
Do you see some rather grim comedy then in the fact that the March on Washington wound up at Lincoln?
I thought it was at that time.
You did. Well, why do people, did people in the Negro movement choose this knowing the history?
Now that is a good question. I have no idea. I should imagine, because the thing was changed from the beginning, from the march through Washington, I should imagine that this is part of, you know, something the Kennedy administration asked and was conceded to while they were in the process of playing host to 250,000 people.
You mean the Kennedy administration asked them to go to the
I should imagine
Lincoln
it, because
Memorial?
In the change of plans, this is just, as I said, the, my personal opinion. Since the march was to have taken a different, to have been done in a different way, I think that when President Kennedy decided that he would recede from there, he cooperated with the march. They said, you know, Lincoln was the myth of America. And once again, you go into a Madison Avenue type of image.
What
and
do you
that
think
way, they had to find some place for people to march between 2 points and then take them through the streets of Washington.
It was a matter of logistics then.
I think possibly, yes.
What do you think of Thomas Jefferson?
Now, you see, I'm very bad with American history. And I'm not too familiar with Thomas Jefferson. I've forgotten anything about
him. He's a slaveholder. He wrote the Declaration of Independence. So there we are, another nice historical crux.
Well, of course, you got people, possibly that were slaveholders, that thought they were good slaveholders and taking care of Negroes, which they really didn't want to be taken care of.
Well, of course, Jefferson was against slavery, too.
Yes, well, this is, but that was the thing of today. And I think you got getting to this thing of days of slavery, where, you know, you had the good slave master and the bad one.
There's some people who say the good slave master was worse than the bad slave master.
Well, I think they made the people too dependent on it. When you had a bad slave master, people would rebel in some type of way. A good one, you know, would just sat there and were taken care of.
Have you encountered a book by a man named Stanley Elkins? The book is called simply Slavery. It's a fairly recent book, several years ago.
I've seen the book, and I haven't read anything for the past 2 years. And I hate to steal the time out for that because I'm constantly
one
of the sorrows of the
business. That's one of the sacrifices one would make for it.
The one that I resent very much.
The reason that Elkins came to my mind is what you said is what he said in substance.
Oh yes, well I hadn't read it.
And I don't mean that this was necessarily derivative, but you happen to agree with
mm-hmm.
him that there was, even in terms of good intentions, a destruction of independence.
And it was in that, yes.
By the part of the Negro, and sometimes it was quite conscious. You see,
deliberate. I think you get this in the schools where you had white trustees, you know.
Yes, even later.
Yes, even later, and even within the system today, where you have schools and jobs and whatnot. And that's what happens with a lot of times the middle class.
What view do you take of Booker T. Washington?
Booker T. Washington, I don't think.
Well, is this a matter of transferring his attitudes and policies to our contemporaries, seeing that they would not work now, or saying that they were bad for that time, which is now quite a long time ago?
It's bad for any time. I think it's bad to go out and say, let's help, you know, clean ourselves up first, and the fact that we're in this position is because of,
mm-hmm.
of bigotry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it gives the people who are bigoted or prejudiced another hold over you. Because, you know, while you're taking all this time and all the odds stacked against you to bring the Negro up to what a white man thinks he should be, it takes centuries.
Now, granting that, there's no argument on that point. Yet you will find people like Mr. Wilkins, or Wilkins, you see, saying, well, Booker T. Washington's intent and aim was, you see, equality. It was not a matter of Uncle Tom as intent, that he was aiming for equality, and, you know, it was a matter of his tactic as of the time.
I have no idea what was in Booker T. Washington's mind. I just don't think he served in the I don't think that his policies were really great there, because mm-hmm. now we're still back, still here, mm-hmm. and people are still, you know, behaving in the same way.
Yes. Mirda.
And you run into this thing now, you know, let's help get ourselves straightened out first in certain areas of leadership before we do. And I think it's a waste of time right now.
That's the Muslim view.
Yes, I know. I said I think it's a waste of time right now. I think their movement, they have done it, but this does not apply to all Negroes in America.
Let's take another question. It has to be highly speculative. How much has segregation given Negroes an alibi for what would be simply personal failures?
Well, this I don't know. And I don't think we're ever going to know it until the far out is talked.
We can't assess it now.
You can't assess it. That's like even, you know, some people here who are fighting are saying, you know, well, I wonder if they're worth it. We can't tell whether they're worth it until the walls are segregated, until that problem is solved. Then you can, that's why we're fighting for lives, then you can judge them on an individual basis. And as I said, there's no, because this thing has such a terrific psychological impact.
But
and importance in so many deviations that you never know why a person is acting in a certain way or behaving in a certain way.
That is the element of alibi and the element of self-pity, or the element of apathy. Apathy, you have said you have to combat, say, about voting.
About voting, yes.
And about even participation in the civil rights movement.
That's right.
But if apathy is there, then you don't separate out, say, self-pity or alibi as well as apathy in the result of segregation. You're not aware of that in the same way.
Well, I think the apathy you get so far as participating in civil rights demonstrations is even self-pity. It's once again this fear of what's going to happen to me if I participate in the things I have to see. It's because you get it in this particular group of people. Middle class group of people, middle class for any area. It shows up as apathy, but I think it's apathy is what is being shown when it has a basis in fear. And then so many times, this is something else that's happened with the student movement, it's very good. So many times, so many years ago, you know, people have attained leadership positions. I have promised people this, that, and the other, and have defaulted, you see, and just left them hanging out there.
Yes.
I think this one thing good in student movement, that they are continuing to move forward against all the obstacles that are thrown up. And I think that's why slowly but surely it's gaining more and more support.
This represents then a kind of, a spiritual regeneration, a spiritual toughening process.
Yes,
is that it?
This is true, yes.
A discovery of other potentialities in the self.
That's right.
This is
a slow process, but it's happening more and more every day. It's happening in Cambridge.
You can detect this.
Yes,
a psychiatrist that I've talked with, who's a Negro, and practices in Connecticut, says he sees this movement as a shift among Negroes from the matriarchal emphasis to the patriarchal, from female to the male emphasis.
I think this is
Negro
true.
Life.
And I think this is very good. I think it should be done. Because
he sees this among his patients.
Yes, I'm sure he does, because, up until this time, unfortunately, most of the time, it's the women who had the job, the women who ran. And if they didn't, then the men had to go out and fight against this white man, you know, all day long, give in to him in order to keep his job, in order to feed his family. And this certainly would slowly just chip more and more of his soul away, his independence, until he becomes sort of a weak caricature of a man. And I think within this movement now that it is slipping, I mean, shifting to the patriarchal type of thing, which we need.
It's funny, the reaction to this question, I've made it in a poll taking on it, but I've seen me ask a few people. Some people deny it.
I wonder why.
I wonder why, too. There are all kinds of hidden motives for denial, I suppose.
They deny that there is a shift, or deny that it was matriarchal in the first place.
Deny that there's been a shift, or sometimes deny that it's matriarchal.
I don't see how they could possibly do this. This process becomes for men, perhaps.
Sometimes.
It's also, of course, possible that men within the movement that are militant, students or adults, might not recognize this because they themselves are not like it. And they may not have thought about it. I think certainly if they think of the structure of Negro family life now, that they would realize this.
There's been a shift toward the white middle class family structure.
Yes.
Away from the matriarchal organization.
Yes. I don't know. Now let me think about that. Now I don't think, it isn't my opinion that Negro male is running his home, but I don't think the white middle class male is either. But what I'm saying is that within the framework of the movement, the men that are working in there now are a different type of man. You know, they aren't going to let a woman run over them.
In the movement,
the people that are working there. And I think this will eventually, because within, SNCC, or within that movement, these people are working as people day to day in their homes and in their lives, and I think this is gradually going to wear off. And this attitude is going to be absorbed by Negro men. And I think this is another very terrible thing that the white structure, prejudice has done.
And which now?
Is to have forced the Negro male into the position of being subservient on the job and in his dealings with white men, because he's had it to do in order to maintain himself economically.
And this is carried over to his family relations. Going back to
except I think at the low income level, in the middle class level, lower income level, reverse, you don't see so much of it.
So much matriarchy.
Mm-hmm.
I have read, and there's no way for me to have an opinion statistically about this, but I have read from sociologists that there you have another kind of matriarchy, that the footloose male just disappears, leaving the woman with a family, or a family. And the matriarchy of that sort, rather than the matriarchy that results when the father is subjected to indignity and begins to lose his self-respect. But another kind of matriarchy, where the woman is stuck with a family, because he just wanders away, gets desperate and wanders away.
This may be his way of dealing with the same problem.
His way of dealing with the same problem. He feels frustrated or incompetent and walks away.
He's not going to
walk
as far as his personality is concerned. Yes,
he goes away, but the family still have the matriarch left.
Yes.
As the family situation. There's a whole line of argument that appears in one form and another about the debt society owes, or the white man owes, to the Negro. That should be put in many ways. Some people put it in the form of, if something isn't done about this, well, society is suffering all over. All society is suffering from this. And that society owes a debt to all people, Negro or white, who are deprived. That's one sort of debt. Yeah, at the other end of this notion of debt is the question of paying back wages, as it were.
It's the Muslim thing, yes.
It appears in other forms, too. It appears in disguised forms. Muslims,
oh, yes.
It appears
in
disguised forms, too.
I guess you get this preferential treatment.
Preferential treatment. And in the old days, it was, well, why not do a little stealing because it's owed to me anyway? You know, that
well, yes, you go through this, you run across it now.
You run again?
Yes.
But now, it now has a disguised social form, occasionally.
Okay. What is that?
In this form, society owes back wages. You see, therefore, I just want to collect my back wages. Mm-hmm. Not saying at this moment in society should be enlightened enough to try to reduce the margin between privilege and lack of privilege.
That's
one thing. But the other has some notion that something is owed me, some special treatment is owed me from back wages, as it were. The psychology is very different from those two points of view.
The psychology, and I think it depends on whether the person or the movement that's saying it is using it as a tactic, or whether they really believe it.
Or whether they really believe it.
Yes, and that's, for example, here, in the beginning, we asked for preferential treatment, too. It wasn't necessarily because we thought it was owed to us for back wages, you know, because we're partly responsible for not collecting it in the first place. But this is because, in the beginning, to break the barriers down, you have to ask whether you never get anybody in a job. And I think that all of us really think, finally, you know, after you get those barriers in, you get the people in there, these types of jobs, and it can be established that they work just like anybody else, or they don't work just like anybody, I mean, you know, that it's not a racial thing, then you can drop the preferential treatment thing. Right now, this particular time, we have dropped it, too. If it becomes necessary, if they still stall, then we'll ask for it, too. But when you get at the preferential treatment, you can't ask for as many jobs as you need to.
Well, preferential treatment, in one sense of the word, is advocated by a certain number, I don't know how many, important white employers. They will say we must shape it in order to keep as a matter of education.
Yes, but I think when it comes from them, it's a valid thing. But I don't think you should use, when it comes from them because of that reason. But I don't think any of us, either white employees or employers, or anyone in the civil rights movement, need to get into this preferential thing or treatment because of back wages do. Because that's liable to boomerang, you know, and come back where people, you know, walk around telling everybody, well, they owe me a job.
That's the psychological point I'm getting at.
Yes, that's why I don't really like to use it. Because as it is now, the Negro doesn't think of it that way. He just wants a chance on an equal basis to get the job. But you're going to have them them back to, you know, they're just simply out of the question, because this will take away some of their respect, too.
That would be a corrosion of that character.
That's
too.
That's right, yes.
It would be a way of initiative.
That's right. That's what they're beginning to build it up.
Let's change the matter of the school busing problem in New York. How do you interpret that? How do you react to that?
Well, I think it's a temporary measure. This is all right, as a temporary tactic, nonviolent tactic. Now, I have no way of knowing right now, because I haven't talked to them, what actually the people in New York think. But I think that if, you know, you're going to bus white students all the way across town to another school, even if it's ill-equipped school, is for a beginning very good, because maybe the school system will go in there and see that all schools are equal. They don't have a problem. All facilities are equal. That all the schools are of good quality.
Well, let's assume that the objective is the same for anybody in his right mind, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's no debate, I suppose, among people of any intelligence whatsoever. But there's a great inequality in the schools, and that should be done with a big crash program now.
Now, that's right.
But the question I'm getting at is whether a massive busing system is desirable. Now, the Princeton plan is one thing, where you have schools that are close enough to allow reasonable busing, you see. You divide and say, you know, you know the plan as well as I do about it.
Yes, I know.
So that's one thing, as opposed to the massive busing system.
I don't know.
The boycott against the Princeton plan now, you see. As I understand it.
The boycott is against
the Yeah, the Princeton plan was proposed you see, by the school board in New York. As I get it, I haven't really gone into this, but this, it was proposed by them, and the boycott was a repudiation of the Princeton plan as being inadequate, or as applied being inadequate.
But as I understood it, I heard Farmer Core the other week, I thought I understood him to say that it was inadequate in the respect that they needed to upgrade all of the schools.
Yes, upgrading all the schools is
done. Along with it.
Yes, yes.
Now, so far as massive busing across town, on the surface, I don't agree with that because I think there are a whole lot of children that are going to be emotionally involved in this type of thing. You know. But then there are some people who say that this is part of the white community's redemptive suffering, which I also believe that possibly this should be true too. But where you get the school board and the state officials are the ones that are really responsible who aren't providing an adequate solution, then you're placing the burden of the trouble on people in general. However, the situation should continue. I would say, yeah, bus them all the way across town, and maybe the parents and students have to be bused all the way across town and get up and ask the school board to do something too.
As a matter of tactic, that's usually this is a threat if schools are improved.
That's right.
What about Washington? Where are you going to bus the children from in Washington? To apply to Washington.
I don't know. Washington always confuses me. I was asked about it last summer. They said they had 85% Negro population.
So,
it's really,
school population, 85%.
Yes. So I think in that respect, the only thing I could come up with then at that particular time in the conference was that the same thing, to be sure that all the school buildings are equal. And if possible, when possible, to have the schools integrated, by all means having faculties integrated. By all means have joint school programs where Negroes and whites could be, thrown together in contact with each other, so they each could learn.
Well, that is
and the only other
certainly desirable
is to make different types of high schools, like academic and vocational. Not disabled, where you have to go to a particular high school if you want a particular type of academic training.
But if you have this tendency in the cities like New York and Chicago now, they're all moving toward the state of Washington, condition in Washington, D.C., where you have the
something's going to have to be done about the housing problem, too. Because usually when you get this de facto segregation in these large cities, it's because that housing is segregated. And if it's not completely segregated, it means that most of the whites are moving outside of the city into suburban areas. I think this is where we have to be stopped. I think this is part of the responsibility of any housing programs that are initiated.
As the housing and economic situation would seem to underlie the school problem then, wouldn't it?
Yes, I think this is true.
Just that it can be done about schools in the way of actually improving schools immediately. But the real problem lies at the other level.
At the other level, that's right. So that's why I think predominantly to see that you're getting the same quality of education in every school in the city.
But that's the real crux.
So that you have a standard public education.
That's the real problem, then, and the real problem is not just having a ratios of Negro and white children as such.
As such, no.
But you see the busing threat as a tactical device to dramatize the inequities, is that it?
That's right. That's what I was certainly looking for.
How do you feel about the church and civil rights movement?
I think it's defaulted very badly. I think that the upper echelon of church officials have taken very excellent stands and thrown their support into the civil rights movement. But we find all too often that within the local areas, there's the separate individual churches and ministers are not taking up this responsibility. They give you the excuse either their church program is too heavy or they have to raise funds for this, that, and the other, which I think at this particular time, this is a crisis in both American history and as far as the Negro is concerned, that they need to throw everything they can. I think I think the movement would go much more quickly if they did this, and that the amount of time we have to spend would be lessened in trying to get to a point where things had more or less leveled off.
Are these Negro churches or white churches we're talking about?
Well, I'm talking about Negro churches in that context, and on the other hand, the white churches are also not taking up the problem. They aren't really diligently working on trying to change the attitudes. The church would be a good basis for this, of their membership, or even of trying to set up some type of program where they could be thrown in contact with Negroes or the Negro community where they could change some of their ideas, or to set up workshops on it. When civil rights demonstrations go on within the community, most of them, you know, stand off, particularly in the South. I think this is evidenced by the fact that ministers will come from, you know, the North and the West and go down into the South, and you have ministers already there who are not participating. They get down there and go to jail, and I doubt very seriously if the ministers there do too much to help.
I'm told by some Negroes in Mississippi and Louisiana that there's occasionally very strong resentment against whites who come in to take part in civil rights movement, not necessarily ministers.
Mm-hmm.
Do you encounter any of that here?
You mean from the white resentment?
No, from the Negroes themselves.
Oh, no, not here.
You don't find it here?
No.
It's apparently a real problem in certain places.
Well, I think in Mississippi what happens there is, I don't know whether it's so much resentment, or I don't think it's pure resentment. I think it's fear that they are going to have reprisals set into action against them because they're seen talking to a white person who's trying to help them, or having them live in their houses. I think this type of fear is evident as resentment.
I see. But you had no problem like that around here?
No.
How many whites have come in to take part in the movement here?
Well, we had about 14 of them here last summer doing work on tutorial and, the office for the press releases, the whole thing involved in the movement here. Predominantly for tutorial and a survey that we had done, which encompassed everything, political background, sociological background,
yes,
economic background, what they thought about the civil rights movement, wage levels, the whole thing. And these students, but then all of them were white.
Yes. Well, this is the end of tape 2 and end of the conversation. This is Gloria Richardson, March 2nd. Stop, stop, stop.